Across our series so far, we've been asking big questions about fast-growing cities. How to build enough housing, how to make land legible, how to pay for infrastructure, how to prevent crime from taking root, and how to ensure young people see cities as ladders and not dead ends. Today, we're going to think about how these fit together and ask a slightly more ambitious question. What would a perfect city actually look like in a low or middle-income country, and how do you get there? Welcome to Ideas in Development, a Vox Dev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Curtis Lockhart, founder and executive director of the Africa Urban Lab.
And I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at Vox Dev. To cover these big questions, we have the perfect guest, Ed Glaser, who is a professor of economics at Harvard University and one of the world's leading urban economists. Ed has spent decades thinking about why cities succeed, why they fail, and how policies on land, housing, infrastructure, and governance shape the whole system. Ed, welcome to Ideas in Development.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
Ed, so Plato and Socrates debated the perfect city. Thomas More wrote of Utopia. Today, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia is trying to build his line. Now it's your turn to weigh in. When you hear the perfect city, what are the non-negotiables? What does that have to include in your view?
So, first of all, let me just push slightly back on utopian thinking. I think the road to urban dysfunction is paved by dreams of urban perfection, and that frequently more incremental improvements to city life are a wiser course to follow rather than thinking that you're going to get it exactly right. That being said, you know, I at least have a very strong view of what we're trying to achieve in cities, which is fundamentally the empowerment of individual citizens to find their future, to work their way, to get through life with, you know, a minimum of hassles. It's fundamentally about the freedom to chart your own course and to find your own future. There are many different ways to get there, but there are some basics. First of all, law and cities are strong complements, right? I mean, when we go back to the Code of Hammurabi, we see a number of things which are really coming out of the origins of urban life in the Middle East. Attempts, for example, to create regulations on builders who, you know, if you build something and it falls down and it kills someone, you're actually on the hook yourself in the Hammurabi Code. And sort of the attempts to get sort of rule of law, some degree of internalizing the negative externalities, reducing the crime that can occur, those are really fundamentally central to urban life. Secondly, the second major complementarity of urban life is education, right? Cities exist to bring people close to one another, to enable us to work together in different ways, to buy, to sell, to borrow ideas, to communicate. And learning is a complement to that. Learning both means you have more to teach and you typically get better at communicating. And then the third fundamental is working on the basics of transportation, right? Managing to get around the city in a way that is sort of, you know, reasonable. I think one flaw of many developing world cities is they pay too little attention to pedestrian travel relative to more glamorous ways of getting around, insufficient work on sidewalks or other forms of these spaces. But those are the three things, you know, safety, education, and mobility that I see of as being absolutely central. And I think it's also important that because of cultures are so different and people are so different, that there's not one right way to be urban. That in fact, there are lots of different ways to be urban. And I think that it's important to embrace that.
And for in the developing city context around those three of safety, mobility, and education, if you could pick only a few kind of specific metrics that you'd like to see tracked to know whether a city is in fact improving over time on those three important foundations, what would those specific metrics be?
So I would be focused on above all on safety. Homicides is pretty good in terms of the, you know, it's the only measure that we have. We think that is broadly comparable across time and place because it tends to be measured pretty well everywhere. Whereas things like reported crimes tend to be more problematic. If you're going to give me a fancier tool, I would go for victimization service. So there, we have a strong track record of victimization surveys. But again, you can't trust the reported crime. You have to ask people. And among the crimes that we're most interested in asking is, have you been held up by the cops? Right. So fear of police abuse, which, you know, is certainly not uncommon in developing world context. That's a particularly good sign that something's gone badly wrong with the provision of safety. For mobility, I think we want to see a couple of metrics, both just the speeds. And so things like the work of Gilles Darenton and his colleagues using Google street maps to measure how fast people are getting around. That's a good measure. You can augment that with cell phone data, as many of my colleagues are doing, to look at how people are able to get across space. And that's also helpful. But I'm particularly attracted to measures of mixing. So the extent to which poor people are interacting with rich people, both in the neighborhoods and in their workplaces, and it's really cell phones that enable you to do that. By linking the cell phone of the person with where they seem to spend their nights, you can sort of say something about the income levels, and so you can look at how much people are mixing. And for schooling, I mean, usually it's years of schooling completed, but you can augment that with various tests of you know, such as the PISA test scores. And then, you know, there's a measure that I always like, which is a downstream measure, which is not schooling or crime, but it's in some sense one of the crucial elements, and you've already alluded to, which is the extent of upward mobility, right? To what extent are cities fulfilling their historic paths and turning, you know, poor people into rich people? You know, you started by mentioning Plato's Republic, implicitly at least. And of course, in the Republic, Plato says every city of whatever size is in reality two cities, one a city of the rich, the other a city of the poor, and they're perpetually at war with one another. And that's not surprising. And it's not necessarily bad. Cities are really fun places to be rich, as Dr. Samuel Johnson suggested, that, you know, when a man is tired of London, he's tired of life, for there's all in London that life can afford. But at the same time, they're often less intolerable places to be poor, because they often offer things that aren't there, sometimes safety, sometimes upward mobility. But that inequality is only tolerable when cities are providing escalators out of poverty into prosperity. And so to the extent to which you can have something that measures the dynamics of individual wealth, that would be the fourth thing that I would really like to measure.
And your work has pointed out, and you've already alluded to the fact that cities need infrastructure, but also incentives and institutions. Can you explain what those latter two would look like or mean in practical terms?
Absolutely. So let me tell it with an anecdote. Let me also highlight, just even before I delve into the anecdote, that infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, perhaps above all, is also an incredibly good way to waste an enormous amount of money. And so you really want to be assiduous in applying serious cost-benefit analysis to whatever you're doing. And I particularly worry about things like train systems that are sort of irreversible investments, often which are priced in ways that sort of, you know, appeal to middle-class urbanites and are inaccessible for the very poor. So we want to just embrace our, you know, inner cost-benefit analyst and sort of push hard on that. But let me tell my anecdote, which is I grew up in New York City, and I was raised on a tale of engineering triumphalism. That New York had been a fetid place at the start of the 19th century that was rife with horrendous diseases like yellow fever and cholera, until the wonderful engineers built the Croton Aqueduct and bring in the clean water from upstate and thereby dispelled these awful diseases. Now, it is absolutely true that without the Croton Aqueduct, without clean water, New York would not have become a better place. But in fact, for 25 years after the opening of the Croton Aqueduct, New York was continuing to have cholera outbreaks. Because just building the pipes doesn't solve the problem, right? Even building the pipes and having free water hydrants in different places didn't solve the problem, because water is heavy to carry. And so poor residents of New York weren't willing to pay for their private connection, and they weren't willing to carry the water. And so they continued to use their shallow wells, and they continued to use their pit latrines, and they continued to get cholera. It wasn't until the city started imposing fines on tenement owners who didn't connect to the water system, that you really saw the cholera rates decline, that you really saw mortality go down. And so you really needed what are essentially Pigouvian taxes to get, you know, property owners in this case to internalize the negative externalities of not connecting to the water system, that you saw major improvements. And that's the incentives that go along with that. Sometimes the incentives are about inducing individual people to connect to the water. Sometimes the incentives are about making sure the water continues to flow. So one of my favorite facts from my work with Nava Ashraf and our co-authors on clean water in Lusaka is that the very strong correlation between how, you know, paying by the liter and paying by the month with how long water breaks stay broken. So the pipes break in Lusaka. They break a lot of the time. Sometimes they get fixed quickly. Sometimes they get fixed slowly. They get fixed quickly when the customer pays by the liter, right? Because if they don't get fixed, the water company won't get paid. And so the water company fixes those things. When the customer pays by the month, as they often do in poorer areas, they don't get fixed. And so that's a different incentive, but it's also about incentives to make sure you get maintenance done quickly. And the second element that you mentioned was institutions. And I think that's exactly right. There are lots of different ways of providing water, of dealing with all forms of urban infrastructure. You can have direct public provision of services, right? So then there's a mayor who's directly involved. You can have a separate parastatal entity. A classic example would be the Transit Authority of New York and New Jersey, but you know, lots of the developing world has various parastatal entities. You can have an independent nonprofit entity, like the Turnpike Trusts that existed to take care of roads in 18th century England. And you can have pure private provision. And like China's former leader, Deng Xiaoping, I think, you know, it's very important not to be ideological about this. And, you know, it doesn't matter if a cat is black or white, as he famously alluded to. It just matters whether or not it catches mice. And so we want to think about what institution is well matched for the particular setting. And I will make one statement about parastatals versus direct public provision. You only want to go the parastatal route if you can actually get someone who will lead this entity who has an international reputation that can be lost. If you can get that, then you probably will get some independence and strength from this. But if you just have a local servant of the state, you're just giving the mayor or whoever is the governor or whoever's in charge just a plausible extra level of deniability in order to blame the corruption or blame the incompetence on that. So you really want to maintain direct public control versus having a parastatal entity, unless you can get someone with a global reputation to lose to run it.
And in the cities you've worked on across the world, is there any particularly high return intervention that you feel is often being overlooked because perhaps it's not glamorous or shiny?
You know, there's a line that 40 years of transportation economics at Harvard can be boiled down to four words: bus good, train bad. And there's just a lot to love about buses. Buses are one simple example of this, and this can mean a bus rapid transit system, or it could mean just taking the jitney system and trying to figure out how to make the jitney system safer and more efficient in different ways. And there's a lot of good RCTs that have looked at this. The basic logic of the sort of bus good, train bad is just train systems are just enormously expensive to build, and they're very fixed. And so you have very little ability to adjust to sort of new and changing conditions, which you do with buses. And there are good examples. For example, Istanbul modernized its sort of private bus system starting in the 50s that we can look to for examples of how to get the bus system better. Then there are even more sort of, you know, nerdy things within the bus system or within sort of roads. For example, I'm very keen on figuring out how to do bus procurement better in the United States. In the US, we spend an average of $1.05 million for an electric bus. And you can buy a perfectly nice 36-foot electric bus from Hyundai for $350,000. So we're paying three times because we're having bespoke buses. And I think basically any developing world city that's customizing their buses in the fashion of U.S. transit agencies is making a huge mistake, right? You want to take into account scale economies. You want to buy from large global producers, not having something customized. But you want to be smart about sort of doing procurement more generally. The sort of procurement line that I think is important is the more that you have sort of capable people running the procurement who are relatively well motivated, you basically want to leave them relatively unencumbered. The more that you think corruption is just around the corner, you want to bind them to the hilt. And so that's the sort of crucial thing to think about that. Last sort of, you know, very non-glamorous thing, target road repaving. So together with Gabriel Kreindler and Lindsay Currier, we have Uber data for a month for all of the U.S., which enables us to measure how bumpy all of America's roads are. We're able to use this to measure how much people dislike bumpiness by how much the Uber drivers slow down when they go from smooth places to rough places. But we also are able to show that in 8 of the 11 cities where we have data on repaving, there is no correlation between how rough the road is and its subsequent propensity of being repaved. We are repaving the rough roads just as frequently as we are repaving the smooth roads. So, like, if you want something that's sort of really geeky on this thing, like, figure out some way to target the road repaving in a way that more directly repaves the rougher roads first.
You've been involved in advising Ukraine on approaches to rebuilding its cities after peace comes. What are your top pieces of advice on this front for how Ukrainian cities can build back better?
Our paper on this in economic policy looks at both maximizing benefits from rebuilding and minimizing costs. And the big tension in the sort of maximizing benefits that we highlight is the east-west divide. So the Ukraine has been moving west for the last 25 years. I think any reasonable view of where there is demand for rebuilt structures highly prioritized the western parts of Ukraine. However, there's a political issue which relates to, you know, claims over territory with Russia, which perhaps pushes against that. And I don't know what the right answer is. We are certainly not qualified to opine on, you know, what the right level of eastern rebuilding is. We're just qualified to opine on what the economic losses are likely to be from rebuilding in the east. And so that's a major tension for Ukraine to grapple with, is this east-west divide. The second thing that I think is important is on the sort of minimizing costs. And I think in everywhere where rebuilding on a large scale is being attempted, I think thinking about prefabrication is really important. Ukraine was exporting prefabricated units to the UK prior to the conflict. There's no reason why Ukraine can't be a global leader in the modular prefabricated house space. And I think that's a thing to think about. And I think there are lots of good examples of this. Again, I'm always a big fan of South-South learning. And I have seen amazing things from the Latin American construction industry in terms of prefabricated housing, like high-end sort of plastic structures that are pre-wired for electricity and water, which you can deliver really cheaply. I think this is a good option to think about in the Gaza context as well, and in the growing cities of the developing world.
So for Ukrainian cities, right, as you've just gone over, you and some co-authors have been thinking about rebuilding basically whole urban areas from scratch. Analogously, in sub-Saharan Africa, just based on the speed and scale of urbanization there, the OECD estimates something like 4,000 new urban agglomerations are set to emerge over the next several decades. So just thinking historically, what do you see as both the constraints and the challenges facing these new African cities that are, I guess, most similar to those that emerging European cities, for example, faced during the medieval period when cities reemerged sort of during or after the Dark Ages? What, if anything, can emerging new African cities learn from these earlier periods?
The demons of density are ubiquitous. And you've got to deal with them whether you're rich or poor. And you've got to deal with them whether it's 1500 in France or 2050 in sub-Saharan Africa. And those demons are things like, you know, contagious disease, which spreads easily when people are close to one another and they share things like water supply. Crime, the fact that when people are close enough to each other, they're easy to rob each other. Congesting the highways in different ways. That became an order of magnitude harder once we had cars. So the rise of sort of cars, the ubiquitous of car transport made that particularly difficult. But, you know, cities have been dealing with this for millennia. Remember, Julius Caesar banned wheeled vehicles from Rome for some period of time, showing the level of control over his city streets that would be hard to find in many developing world cities today. But, you know, nonetheless, it shows that he was fighting with it. And of course, just the general high costs of urban life. Those are frequent problems and cities always have to deal with them. And unfortunately, in the developing world, they have to deal with them with often limited resources and a very weak state in many cases. Now, luckily, as you say, we have examples of this. The cities of our medieval past are also examples of places that often had a relatively weak state and often had limited resources. The megacities of the past were typically capitals of empires. And so they typically had at least the strongest state that was around in their time period, at least in their part of the world. And so that meant that Julius Caesar had that power in a way that, you know, most developing world leaders today do not have. The medieval city would have been much more self-governing than most developing world cities today, right? Much more of a sense of, if you think about the city of London in 1300, right? This is a city in which the sort of local guilds are fairly empowered and the sort of local merchants are fairly empowered. And so they're sort of taking on the various regulatory functions. It's not fundamentally coming from the king. And often, of course, cities are bribing the king to have their liberties protected for them. So they actually have this power. So if I were thinking of one thing, it would be like thinking intelligently about how much power you want to devolve to the city itself, to fund itself through local taxes, to pass the regulations that it thinks it should have, and to deal with various forms of infrastructure. Now, it's not as if, just as in the public versus private provision, it's not as if there's one answer. It's not like devolution is always the right answer. But certainly, if you're looking to the European past, like things look better when the city is controlling it rather than when you're looking to the vicissitudes of royal control. The New York story is also a story, which is specifically about, you know, dealing with the last mile problem. And I think, you know, this problem of, you know, the Millennium account builds some sort of a water main, and then poor people in Lusaka, you know, are unwilling to pay the $1,000 connection to it. That should have been foreseen if you know a little bit of urban history in the West, that, you know, poor people are often not willing to pay for those connections. And I guess the last thing I want to highlight is, again, returning to the education front. In many European cities like Paris or like Padua, you know, universities played an outsized role. And so thinking about what you can get out of the educational institution, sometimes which needs to be protected from local authorities. So remember, Philip Augustus, Philip II of France, gave the University of Paris its charter in 1200 specifically to stop the local leader of Paris, the provost, from like beating up the university faculty. And so that's where academic freedom comes from in Paris, was this protection from local abuses. And so thinking about how to work that seems important to me.
And so far throughout this cities series and the folks that we've spoke to, we've learned a bunch of the policies you should implement as a mayor, from finance to land to building housing to urban crime. In your experience, you know, what are the main constraints preventing African urban governance of fast-growing cities actually acting on the growing body of evidence on what works?
Okay. It's not specific to Africa. It's specific to every city I've ever been to, right? But the primary lesson that any economist who wants to work with local governments has to remember, and here I am using my own twist on a management consulting mantra, which is, in local government, capacity eats policy as a light afternoon snack, okay? Capacity is what's really important, because the mayor's got, you know, 100 things coming at her every day, and she's got maybe 5 people who she can give orders to who will actually do what she wants them to do. Now, that's going to differ slightly. The rate of stuff coming at her and the rate of people she can have do stuff, that's going to change over time and place. This was really brought home to me 10 years ago when I was spending a bit of time with Ignazio Marino, then mayor of Rome, that he had like 187 projects he wanted to do in Rome. And as far as I could figure out, he had sort of 2 people who were actually willing to do anything that he told them to do. And you can't just count the size of the civil service. Remember, you know, for Marino, something like 90% of his traffic cops dialed in sick on New Year's Eve, and there was nothing he could do to them, right? And so just counting bodies doesn't actually tell you capacity. What matters is how many people can the mayor get to do stuff. And so the most important thing is understanding the limits of capacity and the limits of people to impact stuff. And I think you also, if you want to get that capacity working for you, you need to listen to what the mayor wants to achieve and sort of try to use the tools of economics or the tools of your research to sort of help them achieve what their goals are. Because trying to convince a local leader to use their spare capacity to a goal that you think is important, that they don't think is important, that is a fool's errand on a grand scale.
And sort of a related question, but somewhat distinct. So you've been one of the intellectual founders of the International Growth Center Cities That Work initiative that seeks to give, you know, evidence-informed policy recommendations to mayors, urban leaders in developing world cities. Cities That Work has been around for some time now, right? So just reflecting on policy advisory, what would you say the biggest learning that you've had in more effectively providing city leaders with urban policy advice such that the odds of actual implementation are significantly increased?
I think almost invariably, like, actual implementation hinges on personal relationships with city leadership. Right. And if there is someone in the mayor's office who's important, who actually likes dealing with academics, and I think of someone like Hugh Cole in Cape Town, for example, as being, you know, in the ultimate exemplar of that, then you have influence. And if, you know, or Jennifer Musisi in Uganda, I mean, an amazing city leader who is sort of very connected to academic stuff. When you have a leader that's interested, it's great. And Cities That Work can be there to help them. But they've got to want to do it. And it's not like just putting out a white paper. I think it's useful. I mean, I'm proud of the various white papers we put out to try to translate academic things into, you know, non-academic terms and to provide simple lessons. And I think that stuff does inform. It doesn't just inform urban leaders. It also informs, you know, the people who are likely to read such things are people with a sort of academic bent, for example, people at Treasury. And that may still lead the people at Treasury to question the local governments about how you're doing something. And so that's effective. But it's not the same thing as actually having direct implementation, which hinges on a personal relationship between academics or between Cities That Work, the Cities That Work team, and the leadership in the city. And those things need to be nurtured. Those relationships need to be nurtured. And they're not, unfortunately, not as common as we would hope.
So when you're advising governments, how do you see them overcoming the various constraints they face, some of which we've just kind of touched on? Are there any particularly positive examples that stick out in your mind of a city leader who managed to overcome the lack of capacity, lack of staff who can do things?
So three mayors that I think are particularly worth thinking about are Jordan Hill Lewis in the context of Cape Town, who, you know, is a friend and someone I admire greatly and is sort of very good at sort of managing to bridge the academic world with the ordinary world of his constituents. Jennifer Musisi, who is not mayor but led Kampala, and she was an outstanding leader during her time period. Both Enrica Peñalosa and Claudia Lopez in the context of Bogota are amazing people. I think Peñalosa is great. I think maybe he sort of pushed too much on the subway front later in his term, but again, he's somebody who I deeply, deeply admire. Those are all sort of people to look for. Also, the current mayor of Freetown is someone that I admire greatly, Yvonne Aki-Sawyer. So she's another sort of developing world leader that I think, you know, we all have a lot to learn from. So I think there are some great examples. It's not obvious that any one's particular, example works well for someplace else, though. I mean, and I think part of the thing is balancing the need to hopefully make some use of global expertise with the need to convince your constituents that you actually are putting them first, because it's always a balance of this. And I really think about this in sort of comparing two American mayors who were the mayors between, let's say, 2001 and 2015 or so, Michael Bloomberg in New York and Tom Menino in Boston. And both of them were, I think, very good mayors. Bloomberg particularly benefited because he was, you know, able to bring on board just amazingly talented people, many of whom continue to have relationships with Bloomberg after his time as mayor. But as soon as you get on, like, Bloomberg was never able to convince ordinary New Yorkers that he put them first, and Menino always was, even when they were doing exactly the same thing. You know, if Bloomberg built an innovation district the way that Menino did, right, everyone would say that was just for his rich tech friends, whereas no one thought Menino was doing that because Menino didn't sound like he knew any tech people, right? He sounded like he was, and so the ability to sort of straddle that line is just absolutely crucial in terms of making things work. It requires a certain amount of, it's very technocratic. It's a very sort of, it needs politics in the sense of convincing your people that you're for them, but not convincing them they're on one, whatever political aisles there are, right? There's no Democratic or Republican way to clean a street, right? Or to fix a road or to push away the snow. And so remaining relatively free from the ideological battle seems absolutely crucial to me, while at the same time being enough of a politician so that everyone who's, you know, an ordinary citizen understands that they, you know, you're bleeding for them. And you're not sort of in, even if you're making use of foreign expertise, you're not doing stuff because they say so. They're doing things because you say so.
And one theme that's come up across our episodes is both the importance of proactively planning, but then also the fact that kind of over-planning can be harmful. How do you balance those two kind of facts or takeaways?
I think of this as being involved in sort of two steps, one of which is like the public spaces need to be planned, right? You need to figure out whatever your road network is and ideally have a relatively clear strategy for how that's going to evolve over time. Even if you're planning where your roads go, you don't necessarily think that you're going to get to the bus rapid transit system immediately. They may be about jitneys in the short run, and then it may evolve. But the private space, I tend to think that does better with minimal planning. I mean, except for dealing with clearly noxious activities that generate large degrees of externalities, which you probably do want to ban, I sort of think that private entities should be relatively free to do what they want. I've been working on a paper with Ilan Berteaux and Tarek Massoud on rebuilding Gaza. And we're really drawn to the parallel examples of post-war Tokyo and post-war Beirut, much more recently. Tokyo proceeded with a sort of minimal amount of direction, minimal amount of planning, other than the sort of basic infrastructure. And it worked out pretty well, in part because of a very simple and very well done process of land readjustment. So land readjustment allows small property owners to collectively pool. You don't need to get to unanimity. You need to get to some majority stake. And then you have some process in which the old land gets swapped for space and whatever thing gets built on it. It's not something that, you know, happens trivially. It's something that requires some degree of public oversight. But it worked marvelously well in many, many, many cities, and certainly works better than a public system in which we say we know what private buildings should go in that place, and we're gonna develop it. By contrast, post-war Beirut, very centrally planned, they managed to create a marvelously high-end shopping district in downtown Beirut, and yet it's totally not obvious what benefit that yields to ordinary Lebanese citizens. And so it creates structure. It sort of is an edifice instead of empowering actually individual people. So I'm certainly on the side of the spectrum that favors, you know, maximal planning for the public spaces that are needed to provide mobility and to deal with sanitation and all those things, but fairly minimal control over what private individuals can do with their property, as long as that's empowered by a process for potentially pooling those private units voluntarily, or at least voluntarily for some form of supermajority, into a larger unit that can enable larger structures to be built.
So if a government donor or mayor asks for your three best bets to move toward, you know, quote unquote, the perfect city over the next decade, you know, what are they? And maybe let's focus that advice on the fastest urbanizing region over the next few decades, sub-Saharan African cities.
So I would be focused on, like, above all, let's get the health stuff. So let's focus on water. So let's try to do what we can around contagious disease and public health. And that's certainly, you know, you would ask me, like, what's the big lesson from Western cities? That the huge returns to public health-related infrastructure are just enormous. And I think it's also, so one of our findings, which was a little bit weird, was things like, sort of respiratory infections also go up when the water breaks. And we thought that was a little bit strange at the time. Maybe it was because of waterborne diseases made you more vulnerable. Another possibility, of course, is it's about washing your hands. And given, you know, how much we think that sort of like basic hygiene is useful for lots of diseases, sort of getting the water working is kind of central. Secondly, I'm going to go back to thinking about, you know, the things where I started, which, focus again on education. The global education agenda remains important, and doing things that sort of enable cities to provide more particularly vocational skills in ways that wrap around other forms of education, that feels first order to me. And I would continue to focus on the sort of education side of cities and making that work. And then third, figuring out what we can do around the mobility front. Often this is about, you know, being smart about buses, being smart about things like traffic congestion. You know, can we do things that are, you know, implementing a sort of simple congestion pricing scheme in the developing world? Remember, Singapore embraced congestion pricing in 1975, when they were a pretty poor place, and they did it in a very simple way. You know, there's no way to actually make streets smooth without actually charging people for the use of those streets, particularly on any new roads that are built. So, you know, certainly in the wealthy world, putting a charge on a road that used to be free could be very difficult politically. No one has a problem if you build a new road with putting a toll on it. So if you are building new roads, let's implement the, you know, congestion pricing from the beginning on these roads. So those are three things that I would be focusing on. Public health related infrastructure, above all related to water. Innovations around schools. And it's not like I know the right answer, but we do know the right technology, right? I mean, randomized controlled trials involving experimental innovations of different forms, that's the right way to go in terms of upskilling people. And we'll just have the humility to learn and figure out what works. And third, let's try to be smart about, you know, use of roads, about bus procurement, about thinking about different ways of getting mobility to ordinary people and to making our cities, you know, places where people can connect with one another, not places in which people are trapped either to take a 3-hour commute or they have to stay in their highly poor area.
And big picture, Ed, what are your biggest hopes and biggest worries for the future of cities in particular developing countries?
Well, wars are bad. So I worry about continued conflict blowing stuff up, without making any particular statement on any particular conflict. But wars are tough for cities, and cities are, of course, very vulnerable to things like bombing. I worry about future plagues. So the COVID pandemic reminds us that cities are the, you know, points of the nodes of on our global lattice of travel and trade. They're the points of entry for goods, for people, for ideas and viruses. And cities are vulnerable. They're also vulnerable because people live close to one another and interact with each other in cities. And so I fear I fear pandemics as well. And I continue to fear the slow path of improvements in self-government in developing world cities. Those are my fears. But I live in a world of much more hope than a fear. And when I think about the past 3,000 years of urban life throughout the world, I see a lot to be hopeful about. I mean, 4,000 of years, even before Socrates and Plato were arguing over the ideal city, right? Cities have been enabling this sort of miraculous things to happen of, you know, brilliant people like those two Greek philosophers learning from one another, you know, creating those collaborative chains of ingenuity that have powered humanity's greatest hits, whether or not it's classical Athenian philosophy or classical Athenian drama or the Renaissance or the Industrial Revolution, or, you know, any number of things that are happening throughout the world today, and have enabled ordinary individuals to find their way out of rural poverty into something that's more positive, that's something that has hope, that's something that has change. And I think that, to me, is ultimately what cities are about. They're about enabling possibilities for ordinary people that we would never find on our own. We are so fundamentally a social species that is strong when we are embedded with a group of other people and are so fundamentally weak when we're on our own. And cities are fundamentally about enabling us to work together. And I think that's something that, you know, should give all of us a great deal to be hopeful for.
This has been Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. All of our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.